Morning, everybody. Welcome back. We are learning today. We have a very fascinating opportunity today, and that is that today we get to welcome Harav Yaakov Nagen from Israel, who's joining us. And Rav Nagen is a prolific speaker and author. In fact, I myself have personally benefited from many of his ideas. He has actually now just translated his Sefer, L'Hitorer L'Yom Chadash, which Shelley. Well, Shelley Galambeck gifted me a year ago, and I've been had the opportunity of going through it, and it's just been translated now into English. Be, become, and bless, and that's they are for sale after the shir as well with Rav Nagen. Really, just remarkable Renaissance perspective, really very fascinating perspectives into our Judaism. So we're going to break up the morning the following. I'm going to give the first little bit, and then Rav Nagen is going to take on in the second bit, and we really have it's a treat for us together to be learning in this. In this forum. I would also want to thank our sponsors this morning, Shelley and Anne Galambeck, who are sponsoring the Ili Nishmas, Shelley's mother, Mrs. Elaine Galambeck, Elka Bas Rav Moshe Halevi, Aleha Hasholom, whose yotzat is Chav Cheshon, coming up in the next month as we're about to enter Rosh Chodesh. Also by Shimi and Rachel Leifer on the Ili Nishmas, Shimi's grandfather, Binyamin Zev ben Aryeh Lev Olav HaShalom. And we thank him, Shimi, for being instrumental in bringing Rav Nagen out to America. And by Dr. Paul and Yael Weinberg, Ili Nishmas, Paul's son, Nachum Uri ben Meir Pinchas Yehuda Olav HaShalom. This is the sixth Yortzeit, will be this evening. And his memory continues to be a blessing to all who knew him and all who continue to remember him and espouse the values that Nachum brought to this world. And we also thank the Hamlets who are sponsoring Ili Nishmas, Golda Rickel Bas Chaim, Mrs. Martha Schwartz, that is Ruchi's mother, whose yahrzeit will be this coming Shabbos, Dalad Cheshvan, Shabil Ilui Nishmasayim. And thank you for being part of this shir. Let's learn together. We have a little bit of time at the beginning over here to learn about the topic. Rav Nagen is going to be talking about the notion of spirituality, so I figured we'd go into an idea which is related. And I'd like to start off with really a challenging remark which was printed 2 years ago to this week. It was an article which was written by a senior in Florida, a senior in high school, by the last name of Gross, and he published it in the blog of the Times of Israel. And he was talking about what it means to grow up as a modern Orthodox teenager and what his experience of that world is. And he says some very difficult things. In fact, he was denied publication by a number of local Jewish publications. And when he put it into the Times of Israel, he has a number of critiques on the system he grew up within. And they're difficult to read because some of them are generalized and some of them are unfortunately one hears them. So I'd like to just focus, hone in on two paragraphs of his and perhaps gain a perspective as we learn a little bit more together from the Torah perspective of this. So here's what he argues. He says, modern Orthodox teenagers can tell you who Kobe, Jay-Z, or even Shakespeare is, but very few will know Rav Chaim Kanievsky or Rav Herschel Schechter. By the way, just to push that further, Rav Karolitz passed away this last weekend. Right. So how many people was that on their radar, as an example? We'll know the history of America in depth, but we won't know how the state of Israel was established. We'll know how to solve complex math equations, but wouldn't be able to read a simple Mishnah. We are infested with American culture and forget our past. We care about our world values and neglect our own. We care more about the Western morals than the true morals of the Torah. We are high school students before Talmidim. We are aspiring sports players before yearning Talmud scholars. We are college graduates before Yeshiva Bachurim. We are modern before Orthodox. Many in our communities take up the attitude that God's laws are a burden or even immoral in certain cases, so they simply write off areas of halacha as if they don't apply. Of course, the kids get the message and proceed to pick and choose whatever is comfortable for them as well. And for the laws that are being kept, we treat them as if they are a checklist. Say more day, I need check. Wash hands, check. Then go to davening, look at my phone, wrap up my tefillin before I land because I'm so eager to get on with my day. But it still counts because I said Shema and Shemon Esrei, right? Check. So this is only one section of the article. It's very, you can hear a bit of harsh criticism over here. And this is from the perspective of a 17-year-old. And when this was printed in 2017, 2 years ago to this week, there was a lot of uproar. There was a lot of discussion about this. You know, people had a lot to say about this. There are people who are deeply offended. There are people who said, you know, how could you talk about this? Is this a generalization? Is everybody like this? Or is this really a fair interpretation? So, and there were other people who said, look, let's think about this. Let's think about the issues that he's bringing to the table. You know, from the mouth of a babe, so to speak. But this is a different level of that. So this was brought up by the Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg, wrote a blog post on this particular article. Very interesting article. Nonetheless, I think it's worthwhile swallowing that pill a little bit and saying, why are we at this place? And I don't believe it's only about the system of modern Orthodoxy. But why are we in this place right now? And so to do this, I'd like to sort of shift focus. If we can zoom the camera out and zoom back in on a different place, and we're going to look at a very spiritual aspect, a very spiritual idea, which is developed in Rav Kook. Rav Kook has a sefer which we're actually learning on Shabbos. So if you don't have the opportunity yet, half an hour before Minchas on Shabbos, there's a very wonderful group of us who learn together the Ein Hayah. The Ein Hayah is Rav Kook's writing on the Agadata, on the homiletical, or the what we'll call the philosophical sections of Shas, and we've been going through it. We're already up to Ma'amar Chof Beis, the 22nd unit. So there really is a lot of very, very profound ideas there. And in his introduction is no simple walk in the park. His introduction is a good 12 pages, and it's exceptionally complex ideas. But what I'd like to do is, in the next few minutes that we do have together, I'd like to try to unpack some of those ideas to understand why it is that we are where we are today. And what some of the challenges that we have today, which are perhaps being noted and by those around us. So here we go. What we're going to do is the first point, is that we know that as we read Sefer Devarim, there is a pasuk tells us that what do you do when you don't know what to do, right? So for men, this has never happened, but you know, but imagine the situation where you don't know what to do. So it's how it goes. The couple's driving along the road, and she says, "Honey, don't you think it's time to ask for directions? This is before the maps." He says, "No, I've seen that tree before. I know where I am." You know, like that's so. Ki polemi mcha davar. When you don't know something, the Torah tells us, what do you do? La davar la mishpat ben dam la dam ben den la din ben nega la nega direri voice bisharecha. Whether it be on a ritual level, whether it be on a social level, you don't know how to resolve the situation. Boy, you'll go up to the place that Hashem will choose, and look at that. I left out the crucial pasuk, which is the next pasuk. And you'll come to the shofet l'kohen hasheyeh b'yemim ahem. You will come to the shofet, to the judge or the kohen who will be in those days, who will be the one who's presiding over you in those days. Okay, so I'm not finding it right now, but nonetheless. So Rav Kook points out a very interesting thing, in that there's two types of leaders that are described over here. There's the Kohen, who's the priest, literally, and there's the Shofet. The Shofet, how would you translate that? Judge, right? Some sort of legal adjudicator of the system. So there's two types of ideas, two types of people that we turn to when we're lost. And they actually yield very different ideas. One, if you turn to a Shofet, you're really looking for a legal outcome, you know? So is the lulav apostle, is the lulav kosher? What am I supposed to do under certain circumstances? The dishes, the kitchen, the fork, right? There's all the different, that we're talking about the legal system, the legal structure of Israel. However, when you turn to the Kohen, it's a very different system. The system of the Kohen is the person we turn to for the spiritual guidance. He's not necessarily dealing with a very specific issue, but he's dealing with a bigger aspect of our lives. Is it a nega or not? Now that isn't a minute question. This is about our holistic lives. Spiritually, you know, Kohen, where am I supposed to be going? Where am I supposed to be turning right now? How is my life? Where am I leading? Where am I heading? That seems to be the different leader of the Kohen. And Rav Kook points out, at the times of the Beis HaMikdash, we had the opportunity of both. But today, we have less, not to mention that there was wonderful Kohanim in the room. But the idea of there being this, we're going to the Beis HaMikdash, and having the Kohen who's serving inside, who can now come out and address the people, and be able to give them spiritual guidance in that same way, the bigger picture is not the same thing that we have as well. The Shoftim are not the same either. But nonetheless, that's his starting point. So Rav Kook describes that Torah itself expands over time and over the course of history. Here's the way he describes it. I think this is perhaps one of the most beautiful paragraphs. Those beautiful paragraphs come across. Listen to this. If you have it in front of you, the printer was having a little bit of trouble. If you don't have it, it will be Torah Shebal Peh. But here's the way he says it. At the very bottom of page 2, he says, Ba'olam ha-ma'aseh, in the world of action, in the world around us, on ro'im ki ha-yitzurim kulam mo'tzi'im es ha-dvorim ha-mo'ilim lohem. humanity, all creatures in general, find things which are useful for them, which are going to help them in life. We'll utilize two types of ideas or implements in this world. Things which are readily available to us. Thank you so much. Oh, thank you, Mr. Mel. Thank you. Oh, that gives us opportunity to wish a mazel tov. Mr. Mel is celebrating his granddaughter's wedding this afternoon. Mazel tov to Mr. Mel, Mr. Shem. She had many, many, many more smachas in Kazunt with Esther and the entire Mishpacha. So he says that when we look around and we need things, we can find, let's say as an example, I can go to a bush and pick off berries and eat the berries, which are naturally in formation, to be able to use them. And then I can also go and I can now take grain and develop it and grind it and dry it and grind it and bake and knead it and bake it and create something else which I'm going to need, which is called bread, which is a developed idea. When we notice, just as there was divine involvement in there being the grapes on the bush, on the vine for me to use, so too Cain ha'ashkacha metapeles gam Cain b'chol advarim she'ilu yitzurim she'tzorech bohem chibur ala sechel anashi l'nisayon l'doros rabim. We can also say that Hashem wanted it to be that over time Hashem wanted the development of the human intellect to be able to take the grain and grind it and knead it and create bread. So there's two elements that Hashem naturally, and we'll call it intellectually developed over time. Hashem wanted these both to be available to us. Because Hashem wanted humanity to advance, and one way to advance is through natural implements, and one through developed implements, which the human brain will develop over the course of history. And we can obviously see this today, and we'll call it the advances of technology that we have today is far more than bread. Whether it be in medical science, whether it be in comfort of living, we're talking about how there's a certain hashkacha, he says, in this whole development. Now, therefore, he says, if that's true in the world of ma'as and the world of action around us, in the physical world, surely it's true also in the world of spiritual development. There are certain ideas which are given to us, well, so to speak, in their natural form, and there were certain ideas which required unpacking and development throughout history. Just like I can take the grapes of the bush, or I can take the grain off the ear and grind it and develop it, so too we have similar ideas when it comes to the development of ideas over history. And he says that Hashem's hashkacha is found in both the explicit word and the developed and sophisticated word over time. Which means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, wants us to spend time over history unpacking what he said and unpacking what Chazal said, because that development leads us to the more sophisticated machinery, so to speak, today. That's what we call the evolution of spiritual ideas. A very, very powerful idea. I'm not going to read the rest of the paragraph, but it's really worthwhile reading this idea. This is a very powerful concept of the fact that until, as an example, Rashi came around, certain ideas were waiting to be developed. And Hashem wanted them to be developed, but there had to be a person with that unique perspective and experience to be able to develop them. And so on and so on and so on, to the point we have today, where we have this unbelievable panorama of expansion, which we're witnessing at the tail end of Jewish history. So then he says, but there's two ways of doing it. There's two ways of development. One he calls Bi'ur, and one he calls Pirush. Bi'ur and Pirush. Bi'ur means, literally, we translate as explanation. Pirush means explanation, so that's why English doesn't really help us here. Nonetheless, Bi'ur, he understands, is the notion, we'll actually start the other way around. Pirush is the notion of unpacking. So let's say, you know, I give you a carton, and I say, you know, here's a carton, and you can unpack it at a time. It's a, you take this out, you take that out, I unpack what's pregnant in this idea, in this carton, and I expand it. That is Pirush. Bi'ur is much more than that. Bi'ur is where the idea it represents actually overflows into a network of ideas beyond it. So Bi'ur actually requires, in a certain sense, is how this idea fits into the constellation of broader ideas. Rather than actually unpacking it itself, it's actually seeing its place in the greater whole. Pirush and Bi'ur. Now, that's in terms of the way we'll call it, say, making bread, right? So as opposed to just pulling the grape off the bush, I'm now making bread. There's two ways of making bread. One is seeing the bigger picture. One is unpacking the individual and micro picture. This actually happened at two stages in history, argues Rav Kook. This is obviously, there's much more to be said. But we see this in a very fascinating way. The Gemara tells us in Sanhedrin, in source 3, Tanya Rabbi Yossi Omer, Rawi hoyo Ezra shetinase in Torah al yodai li Yisrael ilmole kodmo Moshe kidmo Moshe. Really, Ezra HaSofer should have given the Torah, but unluckily, he was at the wrong time in history, so Moshe Rabbeinu gave the Torah instead of him. That's a pretty strong statement. I mean, Lo'ekom Kamoshi Yod Navio Mabit, right? No one in the same category, right? So how does that work exactly? How is Ezra over there? And the Gemara goes on to say that even though he didn't give the Torah, he changed the ksav of the Torah, which means that it used to be that there used to be ksav ivri. The script, the actual script of the Aleph Beis, was a language which looks more like the Akkadian, we'll call it Semitic language, as we see inscribed in Ugaritics, on cuneiform. But nonetheless, he changed it to what we have today, which is called ksav ashuris. So what's happening? I mean, he should have given the Torah. He didn't give the Torah. He changed the script of the Torah. What's really happening? Rav Kook says a remarkable thing. There's two stages in Jewish history, essentially. There's a stage of the giving of the Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu essentially gave us the Torah. And throughout the rest of his period in time, there was what was essentially called Bi'ur, where people, in a certain sense, had the big picture. They could see these ideas. And the way the ideas were developed was when a person almost like looks up at the night sky and sees everything in place. The constellation, everything hangs in place, understands the system. However, what happened was, and that's represented in the Ksav Ivri. The Ksav Ivri is much harder to penetrate. It's much harder to keep for posterity. That was the first version of the Torah, so to speak. But what happened is that we went into Golos. We spent a good 400 plus years with the Beis Hamikdash, another 369 before that with the Mishkan. Afterwards, we went into Golos for 70 years, and the system did not hold water. It was not able to be sustained in a system where we were poured mikli lekli, when we were kicked out. So what happened? So at that point in time, Ezra returns to the second Beis Hamikdash, the second Commonwealth, realizing this was not going to be the be-all and end-all. This is not going to be the last and final Beis Hamikdash. He realizes that ultimately we're on the edge of the precipice. We're going to go back into Golos. There's no Shekhinah, there's no Aaron, there's not the full fulfillment of the second Beis Hamikdash. So what does he do? He starts developing a second system, a system which up till now had not yet been developed, which is the system of what he calls Pirush, where he unpacks the details to create a system of action rather than ideas. Rather than big picture, let's have small regulated perspective. People are having trouble connecting to Hashem on a bigger picture. So what do? I'll give you a Shemona Esrei. I'll give you brachos. I'll give you a system of life where a regular individual will be able to now have circumscribed actions to be able to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right? So it's more, we'll call granular, more detail-oriented, more oriented. It is more related to the specific actions of a human being and regulated in a way which will now survive the vicissitudes of time which it has. Which is why we today still have the constructions and expanded, it will call ritual practice and social practice which is instituted by Anshei Knesset Agdolah till today. They gave us, in a certain sense, they moved away from the realm of ideas and bigger picture and moved into the realm of smaller picture, granular action. That's the way that happened. This is the notion of the Moshe Rabbeinu and the Ezra, two versions of the Torah, and that is represented in the movement from the Ksav Ivri, which was older, harder to understand, script of the Torah, into the Ksav Ashuri, which is easier to understand, but at the same time lacking some of the nuances and facets of version one. What he calls Bior moving into Pirush. Moshe is Ba'abera Satorah Azois, and Ezra was Mefurash Sum Seichel. Okay, Bior as it is. He goes on to say, this is where Rav Kook is leading us. I think this is a very powerful idea. Actually, last night I actually had a meeting of rabbis on a good thing in the community. After 12 o'clock when the meeting ended, I was just, I happened to be holding Ein Ayah, I saw Rafina, and Rafina said, oh, well, what are you learning? So we started discussing these ideas. It's a much more complex idea. And he said, oh, so interesting, because that's exactly what the Maharal says in the Gemara in Menachos. The Gemara in Menachos tells us that when Moshe Rabbeinu went up to Har Sinai, he saw HaKadosh Baruch Hu was tying crowns, so to speak, to the letters. What does that mean? On Choftes on base, he was tying crowns to the letters. Moshe Rabbeinu says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you really need this? So Hashem says, no, there's going to be a person at the edges of history who's going to darshan tilei tilim shel halachos from every crown. Meaning that everything's going to be interpreted. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, show me him. I'd love to see him. HaKadosh Baruch Hu fast forward. He's sitting there at the back of the classroom listening to Rabbi Akiva, essentially the father of all Mishnah and Torah Shebal Peh. His five Talmidim were the ones who expanded the corpus of Torah Shebal Peh in a larger way. And he says, and Moshe Rabbeinu didn't understand what was going on this year. Wasn't happening. He wasn't getting it. So in this Rashla Daito, he became He became weak. He was concerned. How can't I penetrate this? And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, don't worry. It's a halacha l'moshe m'sinai. It's very hard to understand that Gemara. That Gemara requires so much depth. That Gemara has multiple layers of meaning as to what's going on. One level of meaning, the Maharal says, is that what Moshe Rabbeinu was given, also Rav Tzadok talks about this in Resisei Laila, an idea which Rav Kook himself is now developing over here, is the following. Is that Moshe Rabbeinu was given, in a certain sense, the big picture. Moshe Rabbeinu was given all the whole caboodle, the perspective of what Torah life is supposed to lead to. But the development of all those details and how it's supposed to regulate every moment of life, and how it's going to affect every specific nuance in life, had not yet been developed. That was still, in a certain sense, in potential, waiting for the development of the ages to happen. So therefore Moshe Rabbeinu, when he looked at, we'll call it, the potential of the whole system, he could not yet fully understand the applications to all the complexities of life over the generations that Rabbi Akiva v'Chaverov had been doing. That's another way of looking at that same Gemara. That's what Rav Kook is saying over here. There was the Moshe Rabbeinu stage, which was significant, and it was ultimately the bigger picture of things when people wanted to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They'd use their own language at their own times, in their own way. But unfortunately, when we went to God, that all fell away. We lost that. So what happened? Ezra said, let me set up a system over here. Whether you feel it, whether you don't feel it, I'm going to create actions. I'm going to create a system where you know what you're going to do, when you need to do it, and here it is, and here is how it's regulated. That's what Ezra did, and ultimately it sustained us for the last 2,000 plus years. That's how it's been working. So what Rav Kook then goes on to say, and this is perhaps, and I'm going to close with this idea. By the way, we can also appreciate that we live in a generation, therefore, of the Ezra type of Torah, which means we're living in the generation of action. We're not living in the generation of thought, so to speak. We're living in the generation where everything is about checklists and doing, as opposed to thinking and experiencing, just to understand the pitfalls of where we are. We sometimes lose that big picture. We sometimes lose access to that big picture because we're in the world which is protecting us, which has regulated our action, but sometimes we don't have the accompanying experience and big picture, which was what the earlier stage was. Therefore, if you think about this for a second, Rav Kook says the Geula is going to come, the Geula is going to proceed when we get to a stage where we can also supersede the action and reinvest into that action the bigger picture, where I know what I'm doing now, and I understand why I'm doing it. When I can turn to the Shofet, and when I can turn also to the Kohen. The two versions of our Judaism. And today we live in a very granular society. We need to be able to know exact ETAs. We need to know exactly when the 30% rainfall is about to start in the afternoon. We're very into details today, and it's become more so, and our Judaism is detail-oriented. But it's about getting the bigger perspective. Rav Kook argues that in order to be able to understand the bigger picture, we can't look to halacha. We need to look to what he calls Agada and Musar, which is where, pregnant in that, is the potential of the bigger idea itself, which is why his book, Enaya, is on the Agadah. So that's why he's explaining this whole section. This is about the Agadahs and Shas, and the, we'll call, Kabbalistic, bigger perspective ideas within Judaism, which is what he's about to develop. So now, Rav Kook then just ends with one little interesting twist. And there's much more here. I'm giving a very brief summary. If there's any mistakes over here, blame it on me. But it's really worthwhile taking a look at this. This is a very, very beautiful perspective. He says the following. Take a look at these two psukim for a second and tell me, what is the unifying factor between these two psukim? The one is the pasuk in Yeshayahu, the one is the pasuk in Nehemiah. Here we go, here's how it goes. In Yeshayahu it says, it's talking about the future Mashiach. It says, Ki yeled yulad lanu, ben nitan lanu vatiya mishra al shichmoy. A child has been born to us, a son has been given to us, and his authority will be on his shoulder. Vayikro shemoy pele yoetz, gibor aviyad sar shalom. And the marbe hamishra ulasholom ein kates al kisei David v'amamlachtoi lochin oiso l'saado b'mishpot v'itzdokom me'atov adolom kinas Hashem tzvakoyz ta'ase zois. In abundant authority and peace, without limit upon David's throne and kingdom, that it should be firmly established in justice and equity now and evermore. The zeal of the God of hosts, the Lord of hosts, shall bring this to pass. There's a prophecy Yeshayahu has about whether it means right then, or it means in the future, about some sort of scion of David. In Nehemiah, we have a pasuk which seems to have nothing to do with that. And he says, it says, V'eitzah, b'shar hagai, laila v'alpenei, ein ha'tagim, v'al shar ha'ashpois, v'aish, v'er b'chamos, Yerushalayim, Asherahem, Perutzim, Usharia, Ukulu, Ba'esh. Again, it's the vowelization I don't think is correct over here. That Nehemiah is describing as the governor, the Persian Jewish governor of Jerusalem, how he's going out and he's seeing all the breakages in the walls and he's trying to repair the walls of Jerusalem. What is the parallel between these two psukim? Not so easy to say, to see anything here. There's no idea connection necessarily. But Radak and Chazal point out that you notice over here that there is two words in parentheses in each of those psukim. In the second pasuk of the Yeshayahu, there's a pasuk which is in parentheses, which is lemarbe. You'll see that the way it's actually spelled without vowels is lemarbe, the second mem of the word marbe, is a mem sasum, which means it's a final mem which is found in the middle of a pasuk. Whereas, if you notice in the next pasuk, what's in parentheses is ham heim perutzim, the mem sofis, which should be at the end of the word parutz, is actually patuach, which means that in the one pasuk you have a closed mem in its unusual place in the middle of a pasuk, which should only be at the end, and in the second pasuk in Ezra, you have a mem patuach, which is at the end of the word. The Radak tells us, quoting Chazal, he quotes the Chazal, and he says the following: V'yesh boy drash in the second line, kasher yistamu choymois Yerushalayim shem perutzim, v'koz malagolos al esa Yeshua yistamu haperutzim, v'oz tipotach hamishra shehi stuma ad melech Moshiach. When you close the gaps in the walls of Jerusalem, heim perutzim, that open mem, that's when the closed, so to speak, the Malchus Beis David, which is closed right now, will be open, and ultimately the Melech HaMashiach will be able to enter. So says, the Radak says these two psukim are parallel. You say, okay, you happen to find two psukim where you have opposite mems, right? That's all about, says Rav Kook, no. It's two modalities of thought. There's the what we call the Olam HaSasum, the world of action, which is Sasum. It's regulated, it's clear, it's closed. It's a closed system. You can't interpret outwards. And then you have the world which you call Patuach, the idea of thought, bigger picture. What happens in today's generation is the opposites are occurring. We have today where people are essentially trying to close what is open and open what is closed. We have the world of action. Everybody says, is this really Judaism? Is this morally coherent with my sense of Western values? Do I really need to be doing this? Or can't we do a shortcut, Rabbi? I'm sure it'll be all right if, right? All of that is what we're trying to do is we're trying to close the part. We're trying to open the sasum. The sasum is the closed system of action. On the other hand, what ends up happening is we're so same as a patuach. We sometimes end up closing what should be patuach. We don't invest enough in the ideas of Judaism. We don't spend enough time thinking about the why, the idea of where we're supposed to be, why we're doing what we're doing, what HaKadosh Baruch Hu really wants from us on a daily basis. He says only when we're able to protect the action and when we're able to expand the thought, when those two will happen together, that is when the walls of Yerushalayim will be fixed and the Melech HaMashiach will come. Is when we're able to fuse both ideas of history, the idea of action and details, big picture and direction. That is the closed open and the open closed, which ultimately bring in Mashiach. And perhaps a sign of our time is the fact that we sometimes often get lost in action, either by rote or by omission. And sometimes we forget the bigger picture, which is what he is developing. Obviously, this is just a taste, but I think this perhaps lays the groundwork for more of a discussion. Thank you very much, Rabbi Sain. Without much further ado, Harav Nagen, what we're going to do is there are source sheets which are going to be circulated right now. Some pockets. That's a big enough.
What am I by Alex?
How about that? Do you need a source?
I love this source. Good morning. I'm very grateful to Rabbi Trump for inviting me to be with you today. I think it's been more than 30 years since I've been in Lawrence, despite it being the home of one of my closest childhood friends, Shimon Lefer. For many years, every shiur, there's a way that I begin, and there's also another way that I end, and I think the balance in that connects up to what Rabbi Trump was speaking in his lecture. I begin first by saying the day in Hebrew, today's date, and this is to remind me that today's date is unique. It never was, and it's never going to be again. Which of course means that today is unique. And this thought itself is enough to help me make today really matter. I then add a pasuk in from Tehillim, which talks about the simcha, which helps guide me to what vantage point do I want to face today? Because we know so much about life is not just what happens in life, but how do we relate to it? So without further ado, Hayom, Chaf Chet, Tishrei, Tafshin Pei, Ze Hayom, Asa Adonai, Nagila, V'nismacha Bo. Now, I also mentioned in the Lawrence Winmere community, I also have, I'm originally a Ganak, and I'm Greg, and a lot of my family here, my uncle Schneer, my cousins Shelley, are also part of the broader community. I'd like to begin with what for me are the two most significant insights I've had about life. They ultimately evolved and emerged into my present book, Be Become Bless, Jewish Spirituality Between East and West. Both insights come from actually very tragic and traumatic incidents during the Second Intifada. And there's a beautiful book called My Grandfather's Blessings that starts with a story about Yaakov Avinu struggling with the Malach. And the Malach deeply injures Yaakov, but then Yaakov turns to the Malach and says, bless me. And in that book sees the message as even places that we've been deeply injured, to find a way to find even there the blessings. So I feel that these insights, these stories, which are actually very painful, to find the blessing in the insights that emerge from them. The first story is early in the Second Intifada. One of my close students, Avi Sabag, shortly after his marriage, was killed in a terrorist attack close to Otniel. And one of the most devastating feelings after that event was how hard it is to build up a life. We know that how much parents have to give, how much teachers, and most of all, how much a person works on themselves to develop themselves, and how disproportional, it's how it's so easy to destroy a life. Rav Shlomo Kalbach says that's the reason why we break a cup under the chuppah, to remind the young couple and everybody, it's so hard to build things, it's so easy to destroy them. But while thinking along these lines, I suddenly realized that there's another way to look at life. If indeed life is just a bunch of stages that you prepare yourself to the future ultimate destination, when things get cut off in the middle, you feel you never got what you worked for. But if we could look at life as every part, every stage, every day is a world in itself, it's a fulfillment in itself, then we have a different perspective. As I was masbid that Talmud, I said he had very few years, but he had very many days. Because he was a very joyful person. He did wonderful things. He could have been proud of every single day that he had. So I realized that by looking at the perspective of the days, every day as a world, every day as a fulfillment of life, we could have a very different perspective on life. And as I thought this, I was already concerned that time's going to go by, and this insight, which I realize is so significant, as many insights will dim as time goes by. But the next morning, I found a way to ensure that I will always remember this insight. Because when we wake up in the morning, the first thing we do, we say Moda Ani, that 12-word Hebrew prayer. And the Moda Ani, which says, Moda Ani lefanecha, melechai v'kayam, shechazarta bi nishmati b'chemla, rabba emunatecha. We are saying, thank you, Hashem, for returning to me my neshama. We're saying, thank you for receiving anew the blessing of life. For how long is this? Have we received our neshama? We've received it only for today, because tomorrow, again, we will say moda'ani. So when we thank and focus on for today, we have received back our neshama. And that thought could help us, guide us during the day. Because often our heads are filled with so many general thoughts about what are we going to do in general with our lives. And it's important to deal with those questions. But what's going to really determine the nature of our lives is thinking about how do I want today to look? What do I want to be part of today? What do I not want to be part of today? So for me, the Moda Ani became a meditation to begin each day with that insight. Now, I later discovered that Rabbi Nachman of Breslov makes this exact point in the third page on the short sheet, the second source. There's a passage that Rabbi Nachman challenges us again to say that today, all we have in the world is today. Ki ein l'adam b'olamo ki im oto hayom v'oto hasha shomed bo. All we have in life is really today. Ki yom ha-macharat u'olam acher l'gamrei. Tomorrow is a totally different world. And that thought pushes us not to avoid facing up to today. If some people would say, tomorrow I'll start my diet, tomorrow I'll stop smoking, Rabbi Nachman said the opposite. Tomorrow do whatever you want, but today do what you should be doing. This Torah of Rabbi Nachman begins with a pasuk, Hayom im bekolot tishmu. Really finding the focus in today. Now, as you may have guessed, the way I begin every shiur is an evolution of this idea. For me, I start with the Moda Ani, but I meet many people, many students, and the way I share this insight is by beginning every shiur by saying today's date, remembering that today, that's what we have, and then adding that pasuk about the simcha. That pasuk was chosen because many years ago I was saying halil, and I got to the pasuk, Zehayom asa Hashem nagila v'nismacha bo. And I thought, what day is that pasuk referring to? And suddenly I realized the possibility to say that it's talking about today. Certainly the first part, Zehayom asa Hashem, this is the day that Hashem has made. In modern English we'd say, Hashem, you made my day. Or in Hebrew, Hashem, asiti li atayom. Certainly this we could say about every day. But the continuation, here it's a little bit more challenging. Can we really say on every day, Nagila v'nismecha bo? Let us rejoice, let us be joyful on this day. Now, if we look at, if we try to find a reason to be joyful, what happened uniquely and in particular today to justify a feeling of joy, very likely we're not going to find it. But if we choose to look at life with different eyes, to see life itself is a blessing, then indeed that realization, that stepping back and looking with a bigger perspective about what a great blessing it is, life itself, we can indeed say, Nagila v'nismecha bo, on many more days. Although I will say, not on every day. We know that the Torah guides us that it's not appropriate every day to be filled with joy. My students know that there are some set days on the calendar that we never say Nagil Mishnecha Bo. The Mishnah says that on the month of Av, we are Mima'et B'Simcha. We limit our Simcha. So on the first nine days of Av, we skip the Nagil Mishnecha Bo. And also, when there are tragic events in Am Yisrael or in the world, I know today's we're commemorating the massacre in Pittsburgh. Certainly, a day like that, I settle for the first half of the pasuk. Zeyom Asa Hashem. Indeed, we could say on every day, but Nagil Mishnecha Bo, that part I drop, and I feel that often this allows me to connect up to the avelut of that particular day more than any other way. When there's this expectation that I'm so used to starting every shiur with the Nagila of Nischabo, when I forcefully stop myself, that holding back of the Nagila of Nischabo allows me to really deeply connect up to the Avelut. So I feel this practice, not only does this connect up to the Simcha of most of the days, it also allows me to feel the lack of Simcha on those days when this is the appropriate way to relate to that day. Let me say a bit more, maybe about achieving this feeling of Negila of Nismecha on every day, that I think it could go back to what we've read about in this parsha. We know that the curse on humanity is Bezeat Apecha Tocholechem, the sweat of our brow we will eat. But is this really a curse? When I grew up in Manhattan, dreaming of one day making Aliyah, I imagine all the Israelis as kibbutznikim with the Kova Temple and singing the song that they told me in the Hebrew classes in America that everybody sings in Israel, although I've never found anybody who knows this song. It probably was in Camp Musad like 50 years ago, and that's where everybody knows it, right? It's the... I'm sure here everybody knows it. Hachalutz leman avoda, avoda leman hachalutz, zoom gali gali. I always ask Israelis, is there anybody who's ever heard of this song? Finally, after many years, someone raises his hand. Yes, I know it from my mother. It turns out her mother went to Central. So, anyway, but at least in my vision, the kibbutznikim, they're sweating under the sun and they're smiling away. Furthermore, I remember in 2005, after the disengagement from Gaza, the entire town of Kfar Darom, which was an agricultural village, was forcefully moved to a hotel in Be'er Sheva, ironically called the Paradise Hotel. And the people there seemed, even though there were three meals a day, they didn't have to do anything, room service and a Shabbos elevator, they seemed pretty down. For them, Bezeat Apecha Tocholechem gave meaning and taste, spice to their lives. So again, is this a blessing or a curse? And of course, what's the answer? You could take a poll. Bezeat Apecha Tocholechem, is it a blessing or is it a curse? So it's both. And both would mean it depends how you look at it. And that's exactly the point. The Torah, they ate from the Eitz Hadat Tovara. That's often translated as the tree of knowledge of good and evil. But the truth is, Dat, certainly in Hebrew, could be Mudaut, consciousness. The tree of the consciousness of the good and the bad. If our consciousness is good and bad, quite likely we'll say that quite likely, we'll decide that working hard, that's the bad part, eating the bread, that's what we're out for. But had we eaten from the Eitz HaChaim, the tree of life, we could have seen that the totality of life, the sweating away, the bread, it's all part of something big, something beautiful, and the Eitz HaChaim would allow us on everything to say, Zeyo Masha Hashem. In fact, Rabbi Nachman of Breslov says that Zeah, Zayin Yud Ayin Hey stands for Zehayom Asa Hashem. Okay, now I'd like to move, of course, to the second insight, also which begins from a very painful incident. About 17 years ago, in the height of the Second Intifada, there was a terrorist attack in the yeshiva in Otniel itself. It was a Friday night. Two terrorists came into the kitchen where four of our students were preparing the next course, and all four students were killed. And one of the most shocking aspects of that attack, if anything can be more shocking than a terrorist attack in itself, was that while the shooting began, the students in the dining room were dancing and singing the pasuk, Hodu Lashem Ki Tov Ki Li'olam Chasdo. And it's hard to imagine a greater contrast between what happened then and talking about the good. after a long time, and I was always surprised to see that the families of these four boys at the Askarot, they get together and they sing that pasuk, Hodu Lashem Ki Tov Ki Liolam Chasdo. Now, I once saw an insight of the Meah Shiloach, the Ishvitzer Rebbe, that helped make some sense of the situation. On the second page, we have a Gemara from Erevin, which tells about a debate about the nature of life itself. Tanur Rabbanan, Shtei Shanim U'Mechtza, Nechlechu Beit Shammai U'Beit Hillel. Halalu Amrim, Noach Lo L'Adam Shlo Nivra, Yoter Mishnivra. Valu Amrim, Noach Lo L'Adam Shnivra, Yoter Mishlo Nivra. Nimnu V'Gamru, Noach Lo L'Adam Shlo Nivra, Yoter Mishnivra. A debate about life itself. Beit Shammai says it would have been more Noach, which we'll translate shortly, had we never been born. Beit Hillel disagrees. What are you talking about? Noach l'adam shenivra. It is Noach that we've been born. So far so good. We know Beit Shammai is considered to be much more of a kapdan, and Beit Hillel to be much more simchat chayim. But the Gemara's conclusion is that Beit Shammai was right. I don't know what happened during those years, but Noach l'adam shenivra. It would have been more Noach had we never been born. And I can imagine in America probably class action suits against parents for giving birth to us if Noach l'adam shelo nivra. But the Ishbitzer Rebbe takes this Gemara out of the realms of pessimism and brings us back to life. The Ishbitzer Rebbe makes an incredible diuk. He says it doesn't say Tov l'adam shelo nivra. It says Noach l'adam shelo nivra. And there are two things in life. Noach could be how easy, how comfortable your life is. And Tov is how much good is there in your life. And it could very well be the place that we come from, the place that we all return to. It's more Noach, because life could often be difficult, challenging, and painful. But nevertheless, Tov l'adam shenivra. It's good that we are here. And this distinction I find so significant, because I feel this is really the great distinction in life itself, because the questions we deal with, if I look at the people here in this Beit Knesset, if I look at my students, we're not getting up in the morning and talking about, can we choose between good and evil? That's not what we do. The people here are decent people. They don't get up and this isn't the questions, the challenges that we have. The challenges that we have are choosing between the good, the tov, and the noach, the easy. Because if you think about it, do we demand more of ourselves? Do we see other people and their needs in response to them? Many of these things, if we don't do it, we're not bad people. We didn't do something bad. But we very likely chose the derech hanocha, the easy path, and not the good path. 2 years after that terrorist attack, I was standing on the kever of Noam Apter in Shiloh, who was dead in my shiur, and I realized how profoundly this is the teaching of that event. Because in a story that was very famous in Israel then, when the shooting began, the doors between the kitchen and the dining room were closed. It wasn't by the terrorists who tried to break through the doors, and they shot dozens of bullets through the doors. They didn't manage to find the mechanism and break through. And we can never know for sure, but what we think is that the boys in the kitchen realized they had to stop the terrorists, so they closed and locked the doors. And now, we can never know for sure what happened in the kitchen, but we do know other elements of that event which show this point. Another one of our students called Asaf, he went to hide in the bathroom when the shooting began. But that particular Shabbat, the boys were off from Otniel, so other than the boys in the kitchen and a few others, They're all students from Yeshivat Har Etzion that came to have a Shabbaton together. So when Asaf was hiding, he said, if I hide, I know this place. Who's going to take charge of the situation? So he went out of his hiding place. He led the soldiers to attack the terrorists from behind. But since he led, he was very badly injured. He said Shema Yisrael. He closed his eyes. And to his and everybody's surprise, because at first he was considered to be critically injured, he awoke after a few days and now is a neighbor of mine in Otniel. So certainly that was choosing between the Tov and the Noach. And incredibly, just yesterday, I was the scholar in residence in Lincoln Square Synagogue. And right after davening, someone comes over to me and he sees really choked up. And he says, my son was in the dining room 17 years ago when the terrorist attack took place. His son was studying in Yeshivat Har Etzion. And he said his son ran out. But then his son realized that a friend of his was still in the dining room. So he went back into the dining room, and his friend, who was 6'3", who was injured, shot in the leg, he picked his friend up, he dragged him out, and since then his son called his grandson after Noam Apter. Okay, so these are my two essential insights about life. And later, I was able to even find a way to integrate them, because there's a famous anecdote in a book called India by Azriel Kalbach, the founder of the Mariv newspaper, that Kalbach talks about a meeting with India's prime minister. And together, they're talking about the great problems of that country. And Kalbach says, so the question is, what to do? And the prime minister looks at Kalbach and says, well, I see you must be European, because here, we in India, we don't ask what to do, we ask what to be. And in a nutshell, we get the great question about what is the question of life. Is the great question of life what to do, or is the great question of life what to be? Doing is about changing the world, fixing the world, making the world a better place. It's something which is external to us. It focuses on the better future that we're trying to build. Being is being is a focus on our inner world. Who am I? It's focusing not on the future, but about the present. It's not about changing the world, but about how do I accept and connect to the world as it is. And again, the thesis of my book is that there's something very fundamental about the Torah as, first of all, the land of Israel is between East and West. And the Torah, I believe, teaches us how we must integrate these two questions in our lives, to know what to do and what to be. We know that I argue that the two creation stories are based on the difference between doing and being. The first story, we're created B'tselem Elokim. We have to conquer the world, master the world. Time is divided into different days that allows a past, present, and future. People get married to have kids to fill up the world. That's about doing. The second story is about Gan Eden. And in Gan Eden, we have in Gan Eden, we have flowing of water, beautiful trees, no division of time. It's a timeless world. It's not divided to days. And then again, men and women connect not something external to themselves, but because of the inner loneliness, but the becoming one together, the mathematics, instead of two many in the first story, from two becoming one. This is true about the Jewish week. 6 days a week, it's about doing. Just like Hashem created the world in 6 days, we start the week by lighting a fire of Havdalah, which is just like HaKadosh Baruch Hu began the first day of creation with also in the darkness saying Yehi Or. And on Shabbat, it's a day of being. Shabbat, we don't change the world. We say there are 39 Melachot on Shabbat. but it's called, the Mishnah says, Arbaim Chasar Echad, 40 missing one. Because the essence of Malacha is saying, there's something missing in the world. But no, Shabbat, we say, I want to accept the world as it is. I'm thinking not about the future. I'm not even allowed to talk about tomorrow. I try to really be present in today. Now, these, and I didn't look at the time when I began, so please, Rabbi Trump, guide me how much time I have.
15 minutes.
Great, okay, thank you. On the being, it's timeless, but doing, people have to do things, so therefore I know I don't want to overextend my welcome here. So again, my subtitle, Jewish Spirituality Between East and West, is about this connection between the doing and the being. Now, my direct encounter with the East also really connects up to that particular event that I mentioned, because my student Noam, before his death, he founded what he called Merkaz Lemudut Yudit, the Center for Jewish Consciousness, because he always said, we can't wait for Am Yisrael to come to the Beis Medrash. We have to bring the Beis Medrash to Am Yisrael. So before every Chag, he would print out like thousands of flyers talking about Hanukkah or Purim, and have all the guys going home for Shabbos to give them out on buses and trains to be Makarev. And even though he was my Talmud, he would give me all sorts of missions, give a shiur here, do this, do that. And after he was killed, I said, who's going to push me? So I decided that no matter how crazy, if I get invited, I'll try to make it there. And one year I was invited to what's called the Bumba Mela, which is, in its heyday, tens of thousands of Israelis, instead of celebrating Pesach with their family, during the time of Pesach, went to this kind of like a Woodstock-type festival on the beach in Israel. And the Bumba Mela was paired after the Kumbh Mela, which is this Hindu holiday. So I got invited one year to spend my Pesach in the Bumba Mela doing kirev work. So I thought, okay, Noam would have really pushed me, so I'm going to show up over there. And while I was there on the sands, thinking about what am I going to talk about in my shiur, so I said, maybe I'll talk about the relationship between the syllable, which represents the unity of existence in the East, the Om, and our word, Shalom. Shalom, of course, includes Om. And it's used in many similar contexts at the end of prayers. It has a meaning of unity and harmony. In fact, not only is Shalom one of the names of Hashem, but the Zohar tells us that the 72 names of God, that one of them is Om itself. But then I say to myself, wait a second. First of all, I don't think it's true. There are similarities, but I wouldn't exactly say that Judaism and Hinduism are, everything's the same. Obviously not. And number two, I kind of have an agenda. I mean, I'm trying to hope that these people next Pesach won't be going to the Kumbh Mela, and they'll be with their families on Pesach. So then I realized, what do I have to talk about? And because we have limited time, I'm not going to do too much within the sources, but you're welcome to take, which some of the things I'll mention are all written out here, that Shalom includes the Om, but it's not limited by the Om. And the Zohar teaches that what is Shalom? Shalom starts with the letter Shin, which means Esh, fire. It ends with the letter Mem, which stands for Mayim. Shalom is the ability to integrate fire and water. And then on the sands near the ocean, I said, doing and being, that's fire and water. The Om is about being present in the present. Water accepts the form of whatever you give it. And that's wonderful. This should be part of our life and existence. But Shalom teaches us that our obligation as Jews is to balance that being, balance the water with the shin, the fire. So Jews, Om is great, But Jews, we need shalom and not om. Now, and maybe I'll just give two more stories, and these are much sweeter than previous stories, that about stories that emerge from this teaching. The first is, I even have something that looks like bring show and tell. One second. Mark, if you could pass me this. Okay. Oh. And as I look around, I see so many people that I'm connected to, whether I was in school with Mark, and I have my Uncle Schneer here, so this is really very thrilling to be here. Okay, so this isn't an astro box, so I'll tell everyone the story. My book had an unsolicited translation into Chinese, because apparently there are many Chinese that are looking for spirituality now in this time period of, they're not after communism, but there's at least a little bit more freedom to search. And in wake of the translation, I was invited to give a lecture series in China. And I'm on a train from Beijing to Shanghai. Now the train is moving at 350 kilometers an hour. And I'm thinking about Israel. It's been taking them forever to get this little train to go from Yerushalayim to Ben Gurion, and they're so proud of it. And then I see, you know, and I know that in Shanghai there are more than 2,000 skyscrapers, and even Manhattan just doesn't make it. Not to mention Otniel, which is a little bit smaller than Manhattan, and I'm feeling really like a country bumpkin, like what am I? You know, everything's so big and I feel so little. What am I going to talk about with the Chinese? But then on this fast train, I remember this story from the Old West. Then the old rickety trains used to have these cords. They still have them on some of the subways. You pull the string and then there's an emergency brake. So the train's going along and somebody pulls the string. And no one knows why, but after a little bit, the train continues. But then a second time, somebody pulls the string. And now people are really upset. And you see this old Indian guy gets off the train and sits on the side. And people come over to him and say, "What are you doing?" And he says, "This train is going so fast. My body is racing ahead. But my soul can't keep up with it. So I have to stop from time to time." So just like I'm eating from Israel with my jet lag, that guy had soul lag. So so then I knew what I wanted to talk about. I said to the Chinese, "Look, if you brought me here to China, it's not because of Israeli high tech or work ethic. It's because you're going ahead so fast, but you must be feeling that you're suffering from soul lag. So that's why you brought a rabbi in from Israel." And I said, "You know, China now, it's like fire. The way you're making so much progress, your flag is also the red flag of the workers. And I'm from Israel, Rabbi, not so a little bit clumsy, but tries to deal a little bit with the spirituality, the water of life." But it turns out that I must have exactly touched on what they were looking for. Because then they gave me their gift, which they specially prepared for my visit, which was two teacups. A red teacup for China, the red flag, which I quite call fire, and the blue for Israel, the Israeli flag, which is the water, because we know that the Israeli flag is blue and white because of the Tchelet of Tzitzit, which is the color of the water. And they even had a very cute card. I'll pass it around. They wrote Shevet Achim, but nobody told them that Hebrew is right to left. So it's very cute. Just please make sure it gets back to me, because I'll have to go back to China to get another one if I lose it. But what was beautiful is that I returned from China with some really wonderful insights. And one of them, I quoted in one of the Shirim, something that Rav Dov Zinger said after the Levaya of the three boys who were kidnapped in 2014. There was tremendous achdus in Israel at that time. And Rav Dov Zinger said, "What's the Jewish people? Two Jews, three opinions, one heart." And I was talking about how in Judaism, encourages a culture of multiple opinions. And then this Chinese girl raises her hand and says, well, why is it two Jews, three opinions, one heart? It could have been two Jews, two opinions, one heart, and say how important it is to have you know, different opinions. So I didn't know what to answer. I said, I don't know. And I thought maybe it was Rav Dov's quirky sense of humor or something like that. So she says, I'm going to explain it to you. She says, if two people don't have one heart, they're just going to argue, and nothing's going to come out of that argument. But if two people meet each other and they have one heart and they'll really listen to each other, then in the encounter between the two people and their two opinions, something new will be created. And that's the third opinion. Okay, so if two people have one heart, they'll end up with three opinions. Okay, and now I'll get to my last story, and then I think my 15 minutes will probably be up. And if anyone's interested, afterwards I brought a number of copies of the book. When I was in India, I was once, one Friday afternoon, I went to a city called Haridwar, which is holy to Hinduism. I think that's where they have that, the original Kumbh Mela that the Bum Mela was patterned. Actually, I have to mention one last point. When my book came out in Hebrew, Litoralim Chadash, I was once the guest of a community of Alon. And I was telling some stories about the Bum Mela. And I see this person with these long beard and long payas getting really deeply moved. And he comes over to me and says, I was the producer of the Bum Mela. And since was Chozer B'tshuva, and that's why there's no more Bum Mela in Israel. So anyway, so that's... okay, so now... Now, in Haridwar, there's a very major ashram. Ashram's like a Hindu yeshiva. And the head of the ashram... terrible food. And the head of the ashram was then 92 years old. He was called Vijayananda. I was told that originally he was a Jew from southern France. So on a Friday afternoon, Lechvod Shabbat Kodesh, I went to visit him. And he was then not feeling well, so he was in his very modest dormitory room, wearing his orange cloaks as Hindu holy men. And the first thing that caught my attention was that he only had a few books in his room. One of them was Tanya, one Sfat Emet, one was Hasidic Stories by Simcha Raz, and then a book in English, Ariel Sharon, Warrior. And Vijayananda told me his life story. He was born as Avram Yaakov Weintraub, a son of a rabbi in France. But growing up, he lost his faith, was an atheist. But he always was and continued to be a Zionist. When he heard of us from Israel, even though he was sick, he sat up in his bed and sang to me, Yushalayim Shel Zahav, which for him was like almost like a national anthem. And he said that, in fact, in 1948, he wanted to volunteer for the Haganah, but he wasn't taken by the Haganah. And it turns out, because the person in charge of recruiting was a friend of his family's and was scared that the family would get angry at him if he would recruit Avram Yaakov. But Avram Yaakov, although then an atheist, was interested in Eastern spirituality. So he got onto a bus on a boat and went to India, which he never left. Through the years, he saw that many of the ideas that attracted him, the ideas of the presence of divine throughout all of life, the possibility of experience all of existence with an inner unity, are ideas that show up in Hasidut, in Kabbalah, but he stayed where he was. At the end of our meeting, I said, Vijayananda, you know, you've been here for 55 years. I have a wife and kids. I can't stay here for 55 years. So like the story about the guy who goes to Hillel and says, give me the whole Torah on Regel Achas. I said, on Regel Achat, what have you learned after 55 years in this ashram? So he said, I've learned that there are many ways to get to the top of the mountain. But if you keep switching past the middle, you're never going to get to the top. So stay devoted to one path according to your tradition. So I left So I left, and all of Shabbat I was thinking about what he had said. In terms of sticking to one path, somebody who for 55 years stays in one ashram, he certainly stayed one path. But when he added, according to your tradition, is he expressing regret at the path not taken? So I thought, I have to go back to meet him again. So I went back a second time. And because there was a traffic jam, I only had 5 minutes to be with him before I had to catch a train to New Delhi. I come there, and he looks at me and says, when you make it to the Kotel, be mitpalel for me. And I saw later that my intuition was correct, because 4 years later he passed away, and a friend of mine sent me the bulletin from the ashram, and that the ashram said that before dying, he insisted that he be buried, which is very unusual, because in Hinduism they could either put the bodies in the Ganges River or just some due to cremation. And that led them to a dilemma, what to do. On one hand, this is against their tradition. On the other hand, he's the head of the ashram. So they ultimately decided to send the body back to France for burial. By then it had been about 60 years he hadn't been in France. And the family showed up at the kever and said Kaddish. Okay, now I began the shiur with the pasuk that I say every day about, which is really connected to what I said about being. But if I believe that one of the messages of the Torah is balancing the being and the doing, we have to find a way to end with a statement about doing. I also began with simcha, which I think one of the blessings of our times is that the Avodat Hashem is much more b'simcha u'ba'ava than in previous generations, but we don't want this to be on the expense, chalila, of issues of yirah and commitment. So I thought, how will I end every shiur? And suddenly on Sukkot, I got the answer. Sukkot is zman simchatenu. But dafka Sukkot, zman simchatenu, is the time that we read the book of Kohelet. And that last, second to last pasuk of Kohelet, we read, which I'm going to end with right now, we read it twice. And why twice? Because we need a balance. In Hallel, twice we say, Zeh Yom Asah Hashem. So if we want a full balance, we'll have to end twice. The way that I will now end with the pasuk in Kohelet, Sof Davar. Hakol nishma, et Elohim yira, ve'et mitzvotav shmor, ki ze kol ha'adam. Okay, so thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Of course, yeah.